It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 2010, the Post-Gazette reported the Pittsburgh region was ranked dead last on indicators of racial and economic parity compared to 30 other regions in the country regarding black working poor and African-American children. And a 2012 analysis prepared by the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board reported African-Americans in the Pittsburgh region make less than other groups in the same sector of work. But now an effort has been undertaken to address these disparities, a proposed corporate equity and inclusion roundtable. I'm joined now in studio by two of the leaders behind this, Black Political Empowerment Project President Tim Stevens and organizational psychologist Barry Nathan, who is representing the Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. Tim Stevens, Barry Nathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Paul.
Good to be with you.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Tim Stevens, let's start with you. What can you tell us about the lack of equity and inclusion of African Americans and people of color in our region's workforce?
Well, as you mentioned, we created this. Thank you for the opportunity, first of all, pardon me. When we met with Rich Fitzgerald in November 2011 when he was running for office as the new chief executive. And after he was elected, we met again in December 2012. He agreed to assist in helping to lead what we called a corporate equity and inclusion roundtable event. It took about a year and a half to produce the first event. And that was May 13, 2013. The second was June 9, 2014. The third will be next Monday, 22nd of June, and this is 7:30, by the way, with a full breakfast from 8, and then the program goes from 8:15 to a little before noon at the Power Center Ballroom. But we're dealing with the fact, as you mentioned, when we met with the BPEP Planning Council, the Black Political Empowerment Project Planning Council met with Rich Fitzgerald, we said this condition is absolutely unacceptable, the conditions of the black working poor and black children in our region, when we were noted as 40th out of 40 regions in the nation. That's a pretty bad statement. And as you know, Pittsburgh has so often, as a city, been listed as number one in many categories on the positive side.
Mm-hmm.
This negative number one is something that we want to deal with and we must deal with. The people of color, this region, African-Americans, Hispanics, and others, we must be at the table of employment, the table of entrepreneurial opportunity. And one thing I said in May 13, 2013, that part of the roots of violence in our community is the absence of access to job opportunities, the absence, of access to entrepreneurial opportunities.
How does that translate to violent crime?
I think if people are working, if people have full-time jobs, if people have hope, if people have opportunity for advancement, training, mentoring, retaining of those jobs within the African-American families, we're going to have a much healthier community. I think it's a very logical, mathematical equation. People just don't wake up dysfunctional for no reason. There are reasons for this, and we must uproot those reasons and plant new seeds of hope, inspiration, motivation, and opportunities for our corporate community to come forward in an aggressive way and a creative way to make a difference.
How will a corporate equity and inclusion roundtable, as you call it, address these problems? What specifically will be done to correct something that has been really in existence for probably the entire existence of this city,
yeah,
or at least since the Great Migration,
sure,
100 years ago?
We're dealing with uprooting history and creating a new history. We really are. Creating a commitment where there has not been a commitment. On the front of our document from last year, we say moving from well-meaning to well-doing. Sometimes we mean well, but we don't do well. And sometimes we use words that sound good, but they're not effective. And people like Barry Nathan, who's working very closely with us as an active member of our planning council, our working group, I should say, of the Corporate Equity Inclusion Roundtable, which includes agency representatives and corporate representatives, we're trying to take a deep look at how we aggressively deal with the absence of equity, the absence of opportunity. And we invite people to be part of that opportunity as we put together a very powerful agenda for this day that we want to share with you.
And Mary Nathan, talk about the objectives here.
Well, for this particular roundtable, we've taken on two particular focuses, very specific. One is the issue of supplier diversity, which refers to businesses that are African-American owned who would like to do more business with the majority community, with the corporations and companies in the area. That's an area. It's very hard to break in, and this is something we want to really try to focus on. And the way we do that, the way we believe you can do that, is going to be through relationships. And that's really the core of business in Pittsburgh is all about personal relationships. So we have to be very intentional and very authentic about how do we reach out to individuals, business owners, to say, we want to see what you got. And if possible, if it fits with our needs, we want to be able to take advantage of what your resources are. So that's one. The other is the issue of attraction, retention of African-American professional talent, which is a real problem in Pittsburgh, because people of African-American professionals do not want to come to Pittsburgh. So
why is that?
They don't find it an embracing community. It is not a bigoted community, but it is not an embracing community.
Is that by? I'm not sure if there's something insidious at work here, but is some of that by design? Is that how people want it to be, and so therefore we're not going to reach out to minorities, to people of color, because we want to keep things the way they are?
I mean, it certainly could be related to that, but I think the bigger issue is Pittsburgh, and it goes back to relationships. We are a city of who do you know, and we get comfortable with people like ourselves. And so if you've come from outside of the Pittsburgh region, you're African-American professional, you go into an organization and you're the only one there. And if you're the only one there because people's friendships here go back multiple generations, it's a unique phenomenon here in Pittsburgh, you don't get invited over to their houses. So you don't feel a sense of place. You don't feel embraced. And we can extend that then even to the neighborhood circumstances. Where do you decide to live if you're an African-American professional in Pittsburgh? So there's a very complex dynamic about why someone would want to come here and why they would want to stay.
This is this entity called Corporate Equity Inclusion Roundtable is partnered with key agencies and organizations such as the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh and African-American Chamber and Minority Diversity Council in Pittsburgh, and also with the Allegheny Conference and Community Development. And one of the presenters will be the CEO of Allegheny Conference and Community Development, Dennis Jablonski. And Laura Fisher called me a few days ago, one of the vice presidents. And she was saying to me on the phone that we see a new urgency about this conference and what we're trying to do with it. Dennis wants to help frame the day in terms of the urgency of this thing called diversity, equity, and inclusion. That is not just a good thing to do, it is a necessary thing to do for the Pittsburgh region to be as healthy as it can be or could be economically for all people. But there are people who don't want to come to an all-white environment of employment. There are people who don't want to raise their kids in an exclusively all-white environment. And we are committed that people of color not be left behind on the economic train of Pittsburgh. As we have all these number one ratings, we want to be number one in diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that's what we're intending to do.
Let me jump in. How do you, Tim, how do you overcome what Barry's talking about? And that goes back to the relationship problem.
So I think you have to be, again, I'm going to go back to the same thing of intentional and authentic.
Intentional.
It's about making one-on-one relationships over and over again. So it means if in part of the white community, white professionals, when someone comes into the organization, to really make the effort to have them over, to get to know them, et cetera. I mean, to really make this someone that I might like as a friend. And the comparable, same thing is actually going on within the African-American community, because we have a very dispersed professional African-American community, and the same kind of intentionality has to take place, because we have to somehow create a sense of critical mass so that when newcomers come into the region, they say, even if there's not a lot of people yet like me, there's a network that I can form. People are reaching out to me. And this is going to be particularly important, not for the generation like me that are baby boomers, but it's particularly important to the millennials who are looking at diverse communities, and it's an attraction that is a reason to come to that city.
We also want to attract the young people who are already present in our city. We had a young lady who was at our last meeting who was in her 20s, and she shared her experience and that of other young adults who happen to be of color. She was an African-American woman who don't feel a great opportunity in Pittsburgh. And you often hear from African-American parents that their children are leaving Pittsburgh and going elsewhere for employment. People who do have credentials and are gaining credentials through education don't necessarily feel a commitment to stay. And we have to alter that. And I want to mention that those who want to confirm to be with us on Monday, the 22nd of June, which is where this powerful event occurs, it's www.duq.edu/CEIR, www.duq.edu/CEIR, or call 412-758-7898. We expect to have a powerful attendance, a great attendance of people from the corporations, executives, people who can help make decisions, key people, HR people, supplier diversity people, key agency people who can, in fact, help move this conversation along. And we brought in some national people who are going to be here. I just talked to Marcus Miller as recently as last night. He's the vice president of field operations for National Minority Supplier Diversity Council. And we're also bringing in the statewide CEO, Valerie Cofield, who will be on a panel. He'll be one of our keynoters. And Dr. Larry Davis from the University of Pittsburgh will be presenting the university findings of several months ago. He'll be one of our keynoters. And then Keith B. Key, who happens to be originally from the Hill District, who's now a multimillionaire, works all across the country, but also works in Pittsburgh and has produced millions of dollars in jobs and has brought on African-American entrepreneurs and helped create entrepreneurs of color. And so we're using his experience as a guy who grew up in the Hill, who's now a multimillionaire, but who's one who's trying to bring back some income opportunities for not only entrepreneurs, but people who work and who help build his housing complexes that he has developed in Pittsburgh.
That's Tim Stevens, who is with the Black Political Empowerment Project. He's president of BPEP. Also with us, organizational psychologist Barry Nathan. And again, he is representing the Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. We're talking about the 2015 Corporate Equity and Inclusion Roundtable. It's happening a week from today on June 22nd. You heard a lot of information coming from Tim Stevens. We'll have a link to that at our website at WESA.FM. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. I have been told that the phones in the building are down. I don't know if that means the phones going to the studio as well. It might. So if you're not getting through, you can reach us by email at esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Explain the timing behind the rollout of the proposed corporate equity and inclusion roundtable. This has been a problem that has existed, that's been acknowledged in Pittsburgh. We've done programs about it. We had a forum on the black middle class or the lack thereof here in Pittsburgh. We've talked about how the black community in Pittsburgh, the minority community, much of it feels disenfranchised when it comes to police community relations. So how much does that factor into the announcement and the decision to do this now?
We've been working on it for about three quarters of a year. It takes a while to produce this thing. What I have in front of you is one of the drafts. We have the final draft that's going to print today. The Pittsburgh Southwestern Pennsylvania Initiative for Diversity, Equity, Inclusion. We've worked on this thing for, what, 4 or 5 meetings, fine-tuning, even though others have already worked on the document. In our working group sessions, we've reviewed this, I think, at least 4 or 5 times, fine-tuning a game plan that we call the undergirding piece that will be physically handed out, be part of our document. We are doing a new website for the Black Political Empowerment Project. We'll have a whole section on Corporate Equity and Inclusion Roundtable. Just talked to the website coordinator again this morning. At the event, we'll be reinforcing that. People can go to that website to find information about what we're doing and what's happening going forward so that people will – and that includes also new initiatives, Paul, that corporations and companies have begun or are initiating, and how they have worked, information contact. So if people want to talk with that company or corporation about their diversity, equity, inclusion initiative, they can do that. We'll have about, I think, 21 or so summaries listed in our program next Monday. They will be going up on the website. But also, as new initiatives come in, we can augment our website with those. So companies, corporations, and individuals who want to look at what are people doing to deal with this in a real way, they can go and find that.
And this is an interracial effort, Barry.
Right, right. So this has been something that's been on the Jewish Federation's radar for quite some time, actually for the past 3 years. And it's a reflection of our commitment to the And how do you deal with bigotry? How do you deal with discrimination? Our commitment as a people and individual Jews to civil rights, civil liberties. So this is a very deep part of who we are. And that's why we've always been engaged in a lot of the civil rights movement. But this one is a more current one. But I think
and
I want to come
been
back
our
to
key
your...
underwriter, yeah. The Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh and the council, which we appreciate.
But the other point, I want to come back to your sense of why now. And I think a big part of that is demographics, is we are seeing in the beginning of the retirement of the baby boom generation.
Correct.
And because of that, we're suddenly going to be looking at – companies are looking at how do I get more quality people? And if you have a community or a city that is essentially unattractive to 20% of the population, and we're talking about people of high skills because we're talking about people who are earning – you're being offered jobs of between $100,000 and $200,000 a year and saying, no, I don't want to go there. So we cannot afford as a region to lose that attraction.
And how do you create a campaign that allows for an understanding of and makes
the business case
for the value of having a diverse workforce?
A lot of that conversation will take place on the 22nd. It's part of our theme. We want people to help create a diverse workforce because it's the right thing to do. But we also want to show and showcase the business case for that. Some years ago, Sustainable Pittsburgh, in that 2008 or 2009 report, Court Gould, part of our working group, came out with part of that business case as being emphasized and revised. And Melanie Harrington from Vibrant Pittsburgh has been one of our key partners. And Jim Futrell, who's one of the vice presidents of the conference, and they're going to be doing a joint presentation dealing with the demographics in the area and why this whole movement is important, why it matters, why the problem matters to all people, the economic case for a diverse workforce. People need to get that.
And you're not only looking at implementing a corporate version of the Rooney Rule, mm-hmm. but something called a hybrid Rooney Rule as well. Explain
that's,
this.
That's a big deal. And I want Barry to comment on this, but in 2013, we actually had Art Rooney speak. And this came from his father, Dan Rooney, as he chaired a committee with football, National Football League, when they noticed that there were hardly any black coaches,
right.
Head coaches, but there were infinite number of black players. And there was a commitment to at least interview a minimum of one African-American coach candidate for every opening.
Mm-hmm.
Then it widened to some of the top leadership of football as well. We asked Art Rooney to come, the current president of the Steelers, May 13, 2013, to speak about what we call from corporate equity, an inclusion roundtable. The revised Rooney Rule means that people of color and African Americans will be considered from entry-level jobs to the C-suite, COO, COO, CFO, and everything in between. The hybrid Rooney Rule is that African Americans and people of color will be considered before contracts are let, be they construction or professional services. If every company and corporation took that on and embraced those two rules seriously and with a huge commitment, we begin to build black wealth, Hispanic wealth. And I say wealth is if you were not working and you begin to get a check every 2 weeks, that's wealth. If you create a company and make that work, obviously that's wealth. We want to deal with an expanded definition of wealth and something that would be very practical in terms of showing diversity, equity, and inclusion.
So let me use the Rooney's as a great example. And because the key here is, as we mentioned before, intentionality and authenticity. We think of Mike Tomlin as being the product of the Rooney Rule. Mike Tomlin was not the product of the Rooney Rule. They had already met the requirements of the Rooney Rule when they interviewed Ron Rivera. So Tomlin was brought in because they were looking at who are the best quality people out there. And one of the things that the Rooney Rule does, whether it's the hybrid Rooney Rule or modified Rooney Rule, is that it opens your eye. It changes the way you think about recruitment. So you don't always go to the same people all the time.
Correct.
In Rooney's case, it suddenly says, all right, who else is out there? So Tomlin came in not to fit the rule, but because they started looking at a broader top of the pipeline and that broader funnel. And that's the goal of this, is to break frame, to help people think differently about how they approach recruitment, how they approach suppliers, et cetera.
And do you remember the Rolodex? You don't see those too often.
No, not anymore.
I say what is in your Rolodex rolls out of your Rolodex. So if all of you have in your Rolodex or your contacts for job opportunities or contracts are white males, guess what? That's who's going to get all the opportunities for employment and for contracts.
The 2015 Corporate Equity and Inclusion Roundtable is taking place a week from today, June 22nd. And you just heard there from Tim Stevens, who has been one of our guests in studio. Again, Tim Stevens is the president of the Black Political Empowerment Project. And Barry Nathan joined us as well. He's an organizational psychologist representing the Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, we've come to time, but thank you very much
for
an enlightening conversation. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we'll preview Pittsburgh's jazz celebration tomorrow with one of the performers, Roger Humphreys. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tomorrow night at Heinz Hall, the Manchester Craftsmen's Guild joins the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra to present the Pittsburgh Jazz Celebration at Heinz Hall. The concert gets underway at 8 with a jazz ensemble featuring MCG Jazz, Pittsburgh jazz legend Roger Humphreys, along with David Budway on piano, Joel Fram on saxophone, Jay Ashby on trombone, Dwayne Dolphin on bass, and Sean Jones on trumpet. I'm joined now in studio by none other than Roger Humphreys. Good to have you back with us, sir.
Thank you very much, Paul. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you. And also joining us is Manchester Craftsman's Guild executive producer Marty Ashby. Marty, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us here.
Marty, let's start by having you explain how this collaboration works.
Well, it's an exciting kind of out-of-the-box thinking to combine the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with some of the greatest jazz musicians in the world. And we've been able to kind of pull that off in a really big way, in a really important way. We know, as we all know here, that Pittsburgh has some of the greatest jazz musicians in the world, and we're blessed to have one of the greatest orchestras in the world. So as we kind of celebrate the legacy of jazz in Pittsburgh and the historical context of that, we said, what could be better than to pair together one of the great orchestras with its great music? And we're excited to premiere 6 brand new arrangements that have never been done and never been heard before, and then open the show, as you just said, with a sextet that's got some pretty good guys in it.
And then Ramsey Lewis shows up and on piano, one of the legendary jazz keyboard players of all time, and he'll be working with the symphony. And I'm curious how that works exactly, because, you know, classical music is it's written out. It's very specific. You know, you really I don't think there's any improvisation that, that goes on. And jazz, on the other hand, is almost all improvisation. So how do you end up working this out?
Well, you have to come in here tomorrow, then you'll know how that works. But I mean, the reality,
leave me hanging.
Well, come and you'll see. No, I mean, the reality is that, you know, because these musicians are spectacular, they can work within the confines of the improvisation that will happen within the body of the work. So the jazz musicians, the jazz trio that'll be playing with Ramsey and with Kurt Elling, will have their space to do what they do best. And then the orchestral arrangements that we've surrounded this work with will do what it does best and make just beautiful music. And the integration of the two, I'll tell you, we had rehearsal last month to read through this music for the first time. And I think the integration between the jazz and the classical kind of nature of the full orchestra works together perfectly.
And Roger Humphreys, you have to be very excited about going out there, getting together with all this talent, and unleashing your sound at Heinz Hall tomorrow night.
I am very excited. Right now, I feel like I'm still dreaming a little bit because, you know, the different thing that's been happening in Pittsburgh is like has been wonderful, and I talked to a lot of people. It doesn't happen many places or almost any place like it's happening here. And Manchester Craftsman Guild, man, has been doing a wonderful job. And I look forward to playing with Sean. Jay's going to be there, Dwayne, David Budway, and the young man on saxophone.
Yeah, Joel Fram, he's fantastic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm looking forward to also playing with him. So once again, I'm just so happy and overjoyed, you know, that they picked me, man, to be one of the chosen ones.
Well, who else were they going to pick? They needed a drummer. I mean, where else would you go? Oh. They it looks like they found the right person.
Well, I thank you. If they didn't get me on my home number, call me on my cell.
Now, Roger, as accomplished as you are as a performer, I know it means a great deal to you to work with and instruct young up-and-coming talent. And you've had a chance to do that quite a bit all around the city and with the Manchester Craftsman's Guild. How much does that mean to you?
It really means a lot to me, you know, when you start thinking about all the the young drummers like Joey Saylor is getting ready to play on one of the top TV shows at nighttime. I forget the name of it. And Paul Wells, as well as James Johnson III. And you got Tom Wendt, Javon. And see, now it keep going on and on and on. So, but all the young musicians, the little drummers, I like to think of them as musicians because they keep on studying. And little George Hyde is another one. He plays piano as well as write tunes at the same time. And I'm just so happy because they had a chance to study with me, not only to be a percussion, you know, percussionist, but also to be a very good human being and a player to play with people and also like a band leader.
Well, you've played with some of the greatest jazz musicians of all time, and you've done it for decades. You've done it live. You've done it on recordings. Of course, there's the iconic recording of Song from My Father. You were the original drummer on that arrangement and helped form that song, which is one of the all-time favorites for many, many people. But at the same time, you have taught and you have shared your knowledge. And not all musicians, not all great performers are willing to do that. What makes you so willing to do that?
Because as Max Roach and also Art Blakey told me a long time ago when I was about 18 years old or maybe say 14 years old, they told me, whatever you do, man, try to pass it on. And that's the right thing to do. Pass your knowledge on so the music will stay alive in your concept because you cannot be afraid of no two people going to play the lick the same way anyway. So, you know, you pass it on to the student, hope that they'll pass it on to another one because jazz is very important in lives, you know. You're able to play this music, be able to improvise. You can think out of the box about so many other things, not only in music, but about your life.
I guess it was Wynton Marsalis who was accomplished as not only a jazz musician, but a classical musician. He said jazz is much harder. What makes it harder, do you think? Is it the improv thing or what?
I think it makes it harder than just being a person who just interpret and read music because the improvisation is something that makes it different. When you can just speak off the top of your head what you're feeling through the instrument, and it makes somebody else also understand and get the same vibration and feeling that you're doing. Be able to improvise is not easy, and we all know that.
Marty, do these two forms of music, classical and jazz, do they really share an audience, do you think?
I think so. I think greatness shares an audience. And when you've got some of the greatest classical musicians in the world and some of the greatest jazz musicians, that there is something that people gravitate towards. I know I do, in any kind of music, greatness in pop music. It really doesn't matter. I think when it's an authentic performance, people gravitate towards it, albeit classical music or jazz music. I resonate around the ability to improvise as a jazz musician as being a really stunning capability, yet being able to play Shostakovich and Beethoven and make that really soar the way that the composer meant, to me is equally as exciting and equally stunning. And that to fuse the two together is really going to be quite a moment tomorrow night, as you'll see.
That's Manchester Craftsman's Guild executive producer Marty Ashby, and we're also talking with legendary percussionist Roger Humphreys here on Essential Pittsburgh. Tomorrow night, the Manchester Craftsman's Guild joins the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra to present the Pittsburgh Jazz Celebration at Heinz Hall. And again, that concert gets underway at 8 o'clock with a jazz ensemble featuring the MCG Jazz, Pittsburgh jazz legend Roger Humphreys, and five other jazz greats. Marty, explain how MCG Jazz supports the education programs of the Manchester Craftsman's Guild.
Yeah, we were just talking about that out in the lobby. We do a variety of educational things with young people, and one of our signature programs is a thing that we do called School of Swing, which is a band with the great Roger Humphreys and Dwayne and Max Leek and people you know here in town. And we've been doing that for over 25 years, and we bus in all of the third graders in the Pittsburgh Public Schools to see this program. And when they come in, as Roger said in the lobby, they don't really know from jazz. They don't even know what jazz is. But they're at an age that jazz has not become a four-letter word for them yet. So they come in with an open mind. And when they leave, Roger, correct me if I'm wrong here, but they leave just loving this music, scatting, grooving, scatting. That one of the teachers told me last week when we were doing this, they said, well, this is the way school should be every day. You got to love that. And then we went to West Virginia a few days after that and did the same thing for all these kids in West Virginia. We did, I think, six schools in 2 days. And to me, the moment that I knew that what we were doing was impactful was a year ago when a young African-American man came up to me in the lobby of one of the concerts, and he said, Mr. Ashby, you don't know me, but I'm Jermaine. I said, well, hey, how you doing? Good to have you here. He said, I went to your third grade jazz show when I was a kid. I went to Manchester Elementary up the street. And he said, now my wife and I are subscribers.
Wow.
And he never forgot that. It just validates that when they see Master Humphreys here, and to every single school, when Roger takes his drum solo, the kids go crazy because they witness greatness right then and there.
Roger, how gratifying is it for you to expose a young generation that may be only interested in some of the forms of popular music, rap, for example, and may have no interest in jazz, but then once you play it for them, they're so excited about it. That has to be a great feeling.
It is, especially to play a drum and to make kids to be smiling and be happy, through whatever I'm trying to say to them. And honestly, it's very gratifying. Just like Marty said, man, when the kids be screaming and applauding, sometimes I don't know what's going on myself. But, I'm playing from my heart to communicate after I did all this from my heart. And for them to give me this applaud, I think it's wonderful. And one of the greatest things, I think, what we could do for the children is expose them to the music. We don't have enough, program to expose the kids to the music so they'll love it and like it,
And do they get that so much of what they like, the rap, the hip-hop, that it comes from jazz, that comes from the stuff that you're doing and have been doing for years?
It does. And once again, no matter what instrument or what music you're playing, if you can communicate with someone in the audience, you're doing a heck of a job because you're speaking through the instrument, and that's why it makes me feel good if I can speak through my drums and, you know, get your attention and get the kids' attention. But they say, I like that, Mr. Humphreys, you know. It's very gratifying for me.
Roger, you've never strayed far from Pittsburgh. Why is that?
Well, Pittsburgh is my hometown, and it's where my roots are. I had other family in New York City, aunts and uncles, where I stayed when I was with Horace Silver and, say, like Stanley Turrentine. But Pittsburgh is, I can't think of a better place to live at. It has everything going for it. You don't have to go too far to get to nothing. And if you want to, you know, go out of town, you take any of the quick little expressways, airport's 20 minutes away. Can't be any better than that. And also, not to cut you off, a bunch of beautiful people here in Pittsburgh, amongst with my family. I got a big family here in Pittsburgh.
And you've been very dedicated to them.
And I've
been
put
very You put their interests ahead of yours, which I'm sure at times must have been a tough sacrifice. You could have gone on the road and toured and done even more than you have in the jazz field, but you didn't want to do it at the expense of your family.
And you know what? It's like doing the right thing. This way I have no regrets. Because if I hadn't did it, who knows? I would have a regret if I had came home, maybe this, maybe that. And I was just fortunate, man. After being in New York City, I made my mind up to say to myself, I'm going to take New York City back to Pittsburgh. And that was my philosophy about life. I'm taking New York City just because I'm going back to Pittsburgh. I got my roots there. But I'm going to take New York City flavor back to Pittsburgh and live like I was. And what is so nice about Pittsburgh is you don't have to take plays and all this stuff. You know? You don't have to do none of that. And at the same time, it's like I was having my cake and eat it too. I had my wife, my family, my dad, brothers and sisters. All these things really mean something later on in life. You know? And I'm thankful that I took that opinion. I don't have any regrets, you know. And once again, you know, if I could write my own script, I think I would have messed it up. But I didn't write my own script. You know how it is. When you're young, you want to see the world, want to be the famous person on earth. And the decision that I made makes me so happy, man, that I made the right one.
Marty Ashby, before we wrap this up, we're going to be talking about Errol Garner in just a bit. And Pittsburgh has so much history when it comes to jazz. What do you think makes Pittsburgh such a great jazz city? I mean, to have so much talent coming from this one big, small town.
It's amazing. And, you know, I've been here over 30 years now, and every day I learn something new. And as you know, we're making a documentary, a big PBS documentary about the legacy of jazz in Pittsburgh. In fact, tomorrow night, for the first time, people are going to see clips from the film that address just that question. And there's a lot of variables. Again, you're going to have to see the movie to get the real answer of what it is. But in Pittsburgh, there were so many names. We won't go through them all. But the unique thing that we're uncovering is that in addition to being great musicians and having a great sense of melody and swinging, the Ray Browns, the Stanley Turrentines, the Amon Jamals, the Earl Father Hines, et cetera, they were also all leaders. And that is that's something that's really a thread through there. Mary Lou Williams, right? They were leaders. They knew that their music was important, and they had to get it out for themselves in a way that maybe some other musicians that are predominantly sidemen, they're great sidemen from other places. But in Pittsburgh, there was such a collection of leaders that really made a profound impact on music as we know it today, Roger.
Oh, yes.
I mean, think about Art Blakey. All these guys were leaders. Ray Brown, right? They weren't just sidemen. They were leaders, and they had something to say. And it's been a fascinating process these last 10 years working on this documentary. And you'll get to hear more about that this fall.
Okay. Executive Manchester Craftsman's Guild executive producer Marty Ashby, and also joining us, Roger Humphreys, the legendary jazz drummer, who will be performing tomorrow night as part of the Pittsburgh Jazz Celebration at Heinz Hall. It gets underway at 8 o'clock. Roger Humphreys, so great having you back here again. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Marty Ashby of the Manchester Craftsman's Guild. Marty.
My pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
You bet. And coming up, today would have been Pittsburgh-born jazz pianist Errol Garner's 94th birthday. We'll learn about the new home for the archive of Errol Garner's career when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Happy birthday, Errol Garner. Today, Mr. Garner would have been 94 years old. What you're hearing, of course, is his signature song, or what you just heard was his signature song, Misty, which he created the music for. After the words were added to it, it also became the signature song for Johnny Mathis. Also, to mark Errol Garner's birthday, Sony Legacy is scheduled to release a new Garner album called The Complete Concert by the Sea, one of the best-selling jazz releases of all time, which we'll hear a bit of in a moment. But Errol Garner, who is from Pittsburgh, graduated from Westinghouse High School. He was a city kid, educated at a city public school here in Pittsburgh. Errol Garner died much too young of lung cancer at the age of 55 in 1977 and is buried in Homewood Cemetery. In his honor, the late Marcia Glazer, who served as Garner's longtime agent, manager, and civil rights activist, compiled an archive of the musician's career. The entire collection will find a permanent home within the University of Pittsburgh library system. And here to tell us about it is Dean Root. He is professor and curator for the Center for American Music at the University of Pittsburgh. Dean Root, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. Good to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
What do the donated materials include here?
It's an amazing collection. I have not actually laid eyes on it yet, but members of the university library system and our professor Jerry Allen, who is director of jazz studies at Pitt, have been there to New York to see this before it's all boxed up and shipped off to Pittsburgh in several buildings, I might add, throughout Manhattan, because it's that large a collection. So it has photographs, everything from his career. Because Ms. Glazer, who was his business manager and his agent, was a friend of his in Pittsburgh as a kid and was with him from the time he was first performing on air at the age of seven and professionally, semi-professionally as a teenager. So anything that comes from those experiences that he had, whether they're recordings or especially photographs and contracts,
awards.
Yeah, awards, programs, manuscript, that he used with his bands.
And I never realized, you know, it's funny because he played the piano with such power. And one of the signature aspects of Errol Garner is you could hear him, you know, grunting and talking, you know, as he's playing, because all this energy is coming out of him. And what surprised me to learn was that he was not a very big man. In fact, he was rather short, and this ties into one of the items in the collection.
That's right. So 5'2", and he always wanted an assist from the piano bench so he could just be comfortable with the keys. And so there is, he insisted on having at all of his concerts, and there is in the collection the Manhattan phone book.
Not just any phone book, but you know, maybe the biggest one in the world.
That's right. It had to be the right height, and he was comfortable on that one. So he probably that was in the background at a lot of his recordings and even television appearances.
His career is so amazing because as he was coming up, he, from what I understand, was self-taught. He never learned to read music, and yet He had small hands, which is not advantageous for a piano player. And yet he overcame all of that and was a stunning performer and composer.
That's right. And he just was this font of inventiveness at the keyboard. So he could say he was playing a piece like a standard. But there'd be this long, beautiful, amazing introduction to the piece, and you kind of wondered if he's ever going to get there. And then, oh, I'm hearing that piece. And you know, you just realize suddenly that he's in it. And he's been giving you his thoughts about that piece for the last however many seconds or minutes leading into when you actually recognize the piece itself.
Let's listen to an excerpt from maybe the most famous composition by Errol Garner, the Concert by the Sea. And that's Errol Garner, The Concert by the Sea. And again, Sony Legacy is scheduled to release sometime soon a new Garner album called The Complete Concert by the Sea. And that was one of the best-selling jazz releases of all time. What do you suppose, Dean, especially after hearing that excerpt, allowed people to connect so well with that?
Well, Garner had a unique style. You know, he didn't really copy other jazz musicians, and nobody really copied him. But he spoke to the people who knew pop music, who knew the light standards. He also spoke deeply, though, to the jazz musicians. We didn't hear it so much in that little excerpt from that concert, but he had a deep understanding, like what Roger Humphreys was saying a little bit ago, about the ways in which musicians speak to each other in the moment. Because they're communicating in ways that people who don't play the music just can't really quite understand. And he did that. He led his own band. Most of his career he had his own trio, his own small band. They would go all over the world. They'd perform in Europe, wherever it was in the world. One of the great things about the collection is we have all the papers from all those tours. We even have his schedule, his performance schedule written in his own hand for where he was going to be and where he had performed. And all these notes that'll help us, our students, our scholars of jazz, to understand what was going on in his life at the same time that these pieces were being created and these recordings were being made.
And when will Pitt come into possession of all this?
Well, we have it officially.
You have it, but you haven't seen it yet.
It's not fully physically transferred yet.
I see.
It'll be coming to Pittsburgh, and we'll be starting to use it in our classes and public outreach programs this fall as students arrive on campus.
Dean Root talking about the new collection or the permanent home for the collection, the entire collection of Errol Garner's material, which was assembled by his late manager, Martha Glazer, compiling an archive of the musician's career. It has found a permanent home within the University of Pittsburgh library system. And Dean Root, professor and curator for the Center for American Music at the University of Pittsburgh, has been here to talk about all of this on the occasion today of Errol Garner's, what would have been his 94th birthday. Happy birthday again to Errol Garner. And Dean Root, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. Also, check us out in a podcast on iTunes. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.